I thank you for the interest in the topic. I commend you for the job that you're doing with your young people. I really feel that in many ways I'm preaching to the choir here on this topic. You got so many good young people and so many good parents. If it doesn't help you, it helps me to have a tune-up and a reminder. But it's a pleasure to be with you and talk about this topic. I thank the elders for the invitation to come down and the selection of this topic. I mentioned a few options, and this is one that they asked to have. We've been talking about parenting, and we've been talking about mistakes to avoid, not necessarily mistakes we have never made. I've made some of these mistakes. Probably you've made some of these mistakes. But the point of doing it wrong is to remember, oh, yeah, that wasn't the best way to do it. That wasn't a productive way to do it. Here's the biblical principle involved. We talked about failing to discipline, and we've gone repeatedly over the various passages from Proverbs on the importance of disciplining our children. We talked about rewarding misbehavior and the importance of disciplining. The mistake of expecting misbehavior, where the child has trained you to figure, well, that's the best they're going to do, instead of you training the child to do better. We've talked about the not being consistent, which is easy to do, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. We talked about thinking, well, I don't have time. No, you take the time. You take the time, because all discipline for the moment seems not joyful but sorrowful, yet afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit, Hebrews 12:11. We talked about the importance of controlling self. We are not to abuse our children. We are to discipline our children out of love. And sometimes our children may make us angry, and we may need to say, I will talk with you about this in a minute, while we collect ourselves and calm down, so that when we deal with them, we are dealing with them out of love in a productive way. It is being calm, consistent, and in control that's effective. When we're not calm, they don't get the message that we're trying to discipline and help them to be better. They see a very different message. When we're inconsistent, when we're not in control of ourselves, how can we expect to set an example to get the child to be in control of themselves? We talked about the mistake of training them to disrespect instructions given calmly, because we've trained them not to listen until we're speaking harshly. Don't do that. We've talked about don't discourage or provoke them to wrath, failing to parent with joy, and how much joy and rejoicing is important. The importance of using rod and reproof. Just the rod? No. Just reproof? No. The rod and reproof. We talked about settling for situation control instead of training the child. We need to help the child behave, and there are situations we need to control, but don't mistake the two and settle for situation control instead of actually training the child. Remember, Proverbs 22 didn't say control a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. It says, train a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. It's our job to train them. We talked about the mistake of thinking taking them to church takes care of bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. We looked at passage in Deuteronomy 6:6. We talked about letting worldliness into our family, and we talked about clothing choices, etc. We talked about assuming cultural norms and going into defense mode, and that brings us to this point, which ties in to Brother Kinderball's sermon a while back. This was not a point when I was doing this series a number of years ago. This was one that got added in later, and I'm going to describe to you the two young men that convinced me that this needed to be really stressed. We had a lot of fine families and fine kids up in Pennsylvania. I live in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And we've had a number of homeschooling people up there. At one time, we had about 13 families all homeschooling. You don't have to homeschool. You can do a good job with your kids in public school, but be involved in your kids' life and be involved, know what's going on with the school, et cetera, and that type of thing. If you choose a homeschool, there's advantages to that too. But be involved, parents, and actively involved. But these two families, usually families that do that, are very involved with their children, and these families were. And these families were, you know, they came to church, they had Bible studies in their homes, their kids learned their memory verses, they would lead singing, they would teach classes. They were really, 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 really involved. And I want to warn you of a really, really serious danger. Some sins thrive in a religious or church atmosphere. Some don't. If you want to be set up a meth lab, you know, and sell meth, that doesn't fit real well into a spiritual community. You know, if you come in and say, hey, you want some meth? That's not going to go over real well. If you're regularly getting arrested and thrown in jail, you know, that's not going to sit well. Just like mold doesn't grow everywhere very well. But mold grows really well in that bottom crisper drawer of the refrigerator if you leave certain things down there. It's a very prime environment for certain types of bacteria and mold to grow. Pride is a virus that can grow really, really well disguised as religion. All you have to do is think back to the New Testament and the Pharisees. So, two good families, really involved, really active, doing all kind of things that look like above and beyond, and really active kids, sharp kids, smart kids, you know, leading in different things. But for all that their parents did right, it did not seem to occur to either of the parents in these families, especially one on each side, to train them in humility. And so years later, neither of these families are with us now, but years later, the father of one of them came to me. And he said, I'm having trouble with my son. And he wanted to talk to me about it. And I knew what the problem was. And so I asked him some questions. And I knew what the answer to these questions were. And he'd been impressed with how intelligent his son is, and and he'd wanted him up doing things and all this stuff. And so I said, this is when the son, I'd known him since he was a little boy, now he's up in his 20s at this point of this conversation. And so I asked his dad, I said, would you say that your son is intelligent? He said, oh yes. Would you say he's zealous? Oh yes. Would you say he's, you know, conscientious? Oh yes. And after I said several things that I knew were traits that you could see in him, that the father would say yes to, then I asked him, would you say that your son is humble? And he went, no. Well, that's the problem right there. I remember talking to him, and I remember coming back. We'd gone away to help plant a church over at Philadelphia, and I wasn't around as much, but I came back, and there was something going on. I wanted to talk to him. And he'd gotten to where he'd use a lot of psychobabble and stuff. And I wanted to talk to him about one thing. He said, well, it wouldn't do any good to talk to you because you have different foundational biases. And, you know, and just trying to talk to him was difficult. And I talked to him. We had several conversations, and I warned him about his ego. And he told me, he said, I'm a psychopath. He said, he's got a therapist and a counselor and everything or whatever. And he says, I look at everybody else like they're just sitting there in their underwear. The other boy, when he was a young teenager, I was talking to him about his ego, and I said, you've got an ego problem. And he's about 15 years old, and he said, well, I'm a teenager. Of course I've got an ego. Later, he'd gone off somewhere, and like his mother was quite proud of him, and he'd gone away, and he was in another state, and a preacher called me and wanted to know if I would recommend him because they were thinking about using him to work with them down there as well, along with this other preacher. And I assumed that he'd given my number. Later I found out, because he was upset, and I said, I thought you'd give me, I didn't give him your number, and I guess he didn't give him my number because he knew what I'd say. But I said, well, he comes from a really good family, and he said he's got this quality, he's got this quality, he's got this quality. But I said, he's got an ego problem. And this preacher laughed. And he thought, well, we can handle that. That won't be a problem. Was it a problem for the Pharisees? In the book of Proverbs, when it lists six, yea, seven abominations to God, what's the very first thing on the list? A haughty look. Well, sometime later, maybe a couple of years or so later, he comes back and he's upset with me. Now, in the meantime, by the way, he had come back another time and he had this long hair. I wouldn't have asked him to lead singing, but somebody asked him to lead singing. And he got out there and he was coming down the aisles and he's like, you know, just all kind of stuff like this and going down the aisles. And one of the ladies talked to him about it afterwards, and he came to me and thought, she thought, you know, he knew that she thought that was kind of inappropriate. And I described another time where he was just, see, and he said, well, I like to be the center of attention. Brother Kinnebaugh, I don't remember if you remember what you talked about. Well, you might have been over there several times, but one time when you were talking to us and young men and everything else, what I really appreciated, you kept saying over and over, talking about going out and teaching the gospel, you said, it's not about you. And this fellow comes back to me later, and by then he's into other things too. He's thinking we can speak in tongues and different things. And he was upset with me. He said, you told two preachers that I have an attitude problem, that I have an ego problem. I said, no, I didn't. I told one. He said, well, two preachers told me I had an ego problem. The other information didn't come from me, but it probably came from the first guy, perhaps, who laughed about it, thought it wasn't going to be a problem. Or it may be, you know, if you smell real bad, you don't have to have other people tell other people that you smell real bad. If they're around you, they may end up noticing it. I want to stress this because, you know what? There's a lot of good families in here. There's a lot of good people in here. And when our sons do a good job song leading, how do we feel? We're very pleased with that, aren't we? If they do a real good job on a lesson or teaching a class, we're very pleased with that. Do not train your children to make it about them. Train humility. It is the first abomination before God. Be aware of a culture that celebrates youth, lacks respect for its elders. The one step will then lead to the other when you have people that are just very, very disrespectful and they start to think that they know everything. And put your child to the fool test. You know, there's all sorts of things you can test. You can test your water if you want to find out if you got a well and you want to see if there's bacteria in it. There's a test for that. There's tests for just about anything or all sorts of things. There's a fool test in the Bible. If you want to know if your son is a fool or not, what does the book of Proverbs say over and over and over? Correct a fool, and he'll hate you for it. Correct a fool, he won't like it. Correct a wise man, and he will be wiser still. Correct a wise man, and he will love you for it. You know what the fool test is? If you've got three kids, just stop and think about it. When I correct this one, does he appreciate it? Not a fool. When I correct this one, does he appreciate it? Yeah, not a fool. When I correct this one, does he appreciate it? No. Does he hate it? Yes. You got a fool there. Now, don't be alarmed. It's not an incurable disease. And if you'll think about it, you will probably think about times in your life or me in my life where we've been that fool. Have we ever been in a stage where we resisted correction, didn't want to hear correction? That's foolish. Whose job is it to train that young boy or that young girl out of that foolishness? That's our job. make sure that while we are, let's just turn to Luke 18, 9 and just look at this description of the Pharisee praying. Luke chapter 18, verse 9. He, that is Jesus, told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I get. The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift his eyes up to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Turn to Matthew chapter 6. Beware, verse 1, beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. That applies to preaching, to leading singing, to all sorts of things. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen of them, for then you will have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. When you give alms, don't blow the trumpet. If you got people to notice, that's all you got. If you're praying to be seen, well, I hope everybody knows how great this prayer is. That's where that prayer went. Number 17. The mistake of focusing on home income over home outcome. The children. If you'll give me a second, there's one more thing I wanted to say about that other one, and it escaped me, but it was important, and I want to give me 5 seconds, and I want to see if I can recollect what it was, because it was important. The brain is getting older, and it went away, so we will move on. Focusing on home, oh yeah, now I remember what it was. There was a statement, I don't remember if it was by John Stott in a book about the Sermon on the Mount, or it might have been C.S. Lewis or something, but somebody made this point. Humility is not a pretty girl telling everybody she's ugly. Humility is not a good cook telling everybody, oh, I know it tastes awful. That's not humility. Humility doesn't pretend that when something's done well, oh, no, it was done. Humility does appreciate when something's done well, but humility appreciates when something's done well, whether they did it or somebody else did it. In other words, when something is done well, you're glad because, oh, that was done well. If it happened to be you, you're glad, oh, I'm glad it was done well. But if it was somebody else, you're glad it was done well. And one thing, even kids sometimes can have trouble learning how to be a good sport. And with a lot of kids, this works when they're, say, 5 or 6 and they're struggling with, they can't stand not to win. And I'll take a little boy, I said, do you like to win? Yeah, I like to win. And they don't like to lose. And, you know, there's some ego in there. And so I say, I'm going to play a game where you can win. And they like that, you know. Okay, so I said, I'm going to flip a coin. And instead of you saying if it's heads or tails, you just tell me what kind of coin it is. And so it's a nickel, okay? And so we're going to use you for example here. And so I take that nickel and I flip it. And I say, what is it? And he says, it's a nickel. Yeah, wow, you are really, really good. We flip it again. Nickel. Oh, this guy's good. Nickel. Oh, he's really good. Oh, he wins all the time. And then I have the other kids. Everybody starts going like, yay. You know, and after a little bit, I say, is this very fun? And he goes, no. Why is it no fun? All you do is win. So then when we switch it, this time you call heads or tails. He says, heads. Tails. Try it again. Heads or tails? Tails. Tails. Now it feels better. You enjoy winning more when part of the time you lose. And when you're playing sports, enjoy playing sports. But when you don't, if you only enjoy when you win, you're only going to enjoy some of the times you play. Enjoy it when the other guy wins. Congratulate him on that great shot. Congratulate him on that great play. Don't make it about you. All right, I spent more time on that than I intended to. I mean, it's important because it's places exactly like this among believers, among families who want good and want their children to be doing good things, that if we're not careful, we will create a fire of pride that can destroy their soul and lead to all sorts of problems. And older brethren here, if you can just think of throughout the years some of the people who've done so much damage in churches, what's often been at the very core of it? Pride and a lack of humility. All right, let's move on. The mistake of focusing on home income over home outcome. Proverbs 15, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. Now, if you've got a home and there's love and there's joy and there's a fear of the Lord and you got some nice tenderloin or pork chops or roast beef or steaks, enjoy it. But if you're sacrificing those other things to get the material things, oh, you'd be so much better off without it. It is the home, not the house. It is the family, not the stuff. Do our homes reflect scriptural priorities or cultural priorities? Look at Titus chapter 2. It said, teach the older women to train the younger women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sober-minded, chaste, pure, workers at home. Some translations, keepers at home. I don't believe that means she can't be involved in bringing in income. I don't believe that means she has to be in the house all of the time. But look where the focus is. I did meet a fellow one time who thought the worthy woman in Proverbs 31, he said, I'm not sure she was a worker at home or a keeper at home. Well, yes, she was. But she still, did she contribute to the family income? Yeah. Did she consider a field and buy it and with her own hands plant a vineyard? Yes, she did. Did she make garments? You know, was she up early in the morning, late at night? Did she make garments? Did she take those garments to town and deliver them to the merchants who would then sell them? Yes, she did. But she didn't dedicate herself to a career that took her away and stole the time from her family. Now, in each family, and there's sometimes combinations of events, sometimes there's disease or other things that come in and emergency situation stuff, and in each family, you'll make your own decision about how things need to play out. But keep priorities where priorities need to be. David Hartzell, who, of course, almost everyone here, so many of you here will remember, one time he was asked to go over to a family's house that was having a lot of trouble. So there was turmoil in the house. Things were not good with the children. Things were not good in the marriage. The father had a full-time career away from the house. The mother had a full-time career away from the house. And by the time she got home, she was exhausted from the amount of time and devotion she'd given in her career, and then the kids needed attention, the husband needed attention. She didn't have time for that. Everything was a strain. The kids were doing badly in school, problems in school and everything. And as they're describing it, and she's describing the problem, David said, well, it sounds like a lot of this is because you don't have enough time in the home. Have you considered, you know, giving up that and being at home? And the husband and the wife went, what? And give up all this? Now, what do you suppose the this was they were pointing at? Was it the children? Was it the marriage? It was the stuff. Now, if in your family you're able to have the stuff and you're able to have this much time away and still be focused and a worker at home and things are in balance and priorities are where they need to be, your family makes your decisions for you, but don't forget these priorities, because I will tell you this. Our country has gone into an experiment that doesn't turn out real well. We have gone into an experiment that acts like children do not need parents at home raising them. And so our country, and give it a few years, and there's plenty of people who want to have nationally provided daycare, and everybody will just turn their babies over to a government-sponsored program, and we will hardly even see them very much. That's not what children need. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Six through ten. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, we cannot take anything out of the world, but if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into a temptation and into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. And again, but there's jobs that allow you to be at home a lot, that'll allow flexible things for the hours that you're going to be there and away. There's all sorts of things that work better than others. And again, your family can decide how that works. But I'll tell you one quick story to underscore this point. Years ago, Mike Marr and I were in the Czech Republic, and we moved over there when the Berlin Wall came down. And there was an agnostic couple that invited us to dinner. And after dinner, they invited us for a walk. Now, I want to describe the economic situation of this family. His annual, and I'm going converting to dollars here, his annual income was $1,500. Her annual income was $1,500. They explained, they had a nice meal, potatoes and meat and stuff, but they said they don't buy green peppers very often. Their daughters, two daughters, they love green peppers, but green peppers were expensive. And every once in a while, for a treat, they would buy one green pepper and split it for the girls. They recommended a restaurant to us. They said, oh, you have to try the India restaurant over off of Wenceslas Square. And they said, it's our favorite restaurant. We go there once a year. And then they corrected themselves. They said, actually, we didn't go last year. You know why they didn't go last year? Prices had gone up. A meal used to be $3.50, and it had gone up to $5. So last year, their annual outing to a restaurant didn't happen. Now, this family still had fun. They would vacation to Switzerland. You know how? With their jobs, they had connection with railroad. They'd get very cheap fare. They would go over there. How would they pay for the hotels? They didn't. They slept in the park. How would they afford all the expensive food? They didn't. They took bread with them. And so they slept in the park, and they ate the bread from the Czech Republic, and they saw beautiful things and went home. That's the family that asked this question. She said, in America, you know, do most women, you know, are employed away from the home, basically? And we said, yes. And she said, why do they do it? Do they do it because they want to, or because they have to? She said, I do it because I have to. I would like to spend time with my girls. And she wanted to know, Women in America, why do they do it? Because they want to or because they have to? That's a pretty good question. And again, I'm not telling you that if you and your family have looked at the balance of things and seen what's working and you're sure there's enough time at the home, et cetera, and the priorities in place and the wife's making it, I'm not telling you that's wrong. But I am saying we don't start with what our culture has accepted and proceed from there. Let's start with what the Bible says is the priority and start from there and make sure we fit this before we fit in the other things. Number 18, underestimating threats. Almost each of these could be a sermon in itself. I'm going to mention them just briefly. Corruption from entertainment media. It is extremely destructive. If you don't realize how destructive that is, please talk to somebody. Talk to the elders here. Talk to Bill. Talk to Lance. Find out how much destruction is going on this. Corruption from the internet, and especially internet pornography. Lives are being destroyed. Young men are ending up with all sorts of problems, even at the universities sometimes. The universities who care nothing about marriage, who care nothing about morals, they're starting to counsel young men because they're so addicted to internet porn on the computer that they are not able to function in real life. Sexual predators, old and young, educational agendas of relativism, promotion of homosexuality, atheistic different things, evolution, etc. Feminism agendas, blurring of gender roles. This is just getting ridiculous. When the baby's born, and there's people now, one of the princes over in England, they decide they're going to raise their child gender fluid. I heard about in family, there's a family, they're not telling people what gender the baby is. Okay? What happened? It's a boy. I saw a doctor making this point, and she said, if somebody comes into our office and they ask us to amputate their leg because they want to identify as a handicapped person, we don't cut off their leg. We send them for a psychiatric evaluation. But if people come in and they want other surgery done because they identify as a different sex or gender than they were born, we celebrate that. That's a problem. And listen, there are a lot of people in the fashion industries aiming for a unisex gender blurring look. And there's all kinds of things where guys are starting to have more feminine, you know, way they dress and more this and more that. And don't do that. Guys, be guys. Girls, be girls. You know, back in the Old Testament, the law of Moses, it said, men, do not wear, you know, the woman's clothes. Woman, do not wear the men's clothes. 1 Corinthians 11 talks about that it's a shame for the man to have long hair, and it's a glory for the woman to. Let's keep those things there. This one right before that, I don't have time to talk about it, but if anybody would like to discuss this, I would love to discuss this with you. There is a place for doctors. Luke was a doctor, okay? And then sometimes doctors don't know what they're talking about. There's good doctors and bad doctors. You know what they call the fellow who graduated last in his class at medical school? Doctor. And there's wonderful doctors that save lives and everything else. And there's medications that save lives. There are drugs that save lives, and there are drugs that extend lives, and there are drugs that make life much better. But we are in a culture that totally over-medicates many times, and especially with some doctors. We just had Art Adams with us up there, and he does counseling stuff for all sorts of, he does heroin addicts and different things, and he was talking about abuse of prescription drugs and all sorts of things. One of the scary stories he told was he told about a church where the leadership was real excited because the young people had taken such an interest in visiting the elderly. Till they found out why. They were listening to the announcements. And when they found out that Sister Smith had cancer, the young people went to visit Sister Smith. And while they talked to her, one of them went into the bathroom and was going through the cabinet and getting her, you know, pain relieving medications and stuff and that type of thing. There's some huge problems out there, but one of them is this. Doctors go to school where they are taught biology from an evolutionary point of view. Stop and think about this. I'm going to need to go just a few minutes over time tonight. I'm sorry, but I want to talk about this a little. If you want to talk about it later, I'd love to. They go to school where they are taught evolution point of view, which means how did life get here? An accidental arrangement of chemicals. Then natural selection has weeded out some, but we're still an accidental arrangement of chemicals. So if I'm not behaving the way somebody wants me to behave, what might the presumption be? That the problem is with the chemicals, which means the solution is with chemicals. The Bible says that there is a God. It says that there is sin. It says that there is righteousness, and there are things that are good and bad. Evolution says everything's an accident. The Bible says there is sin, and there is bad behavior that needs to be repented of. Now, there are mental things that really do involve damage, and there's lots of complicated things, but there are also a lot of people prescribing a lot of medication when what is needed is a change in behavior. And I will tell you this, and this was something Art Adams pointed out too, your behavior changes your chemicals. There's all sorts of ways in which your behavior changes your chemicals. And so before you let a doctor or a teacher or something say, I think her name's Peg Tyler, wrote a book, The Truth About Boys. And she went through and she noticed, like in second grade, the boys are doing badly and the girls are all doing good. And she went and she talked to them and she, at first, and they said, well, you know, reading's dumb, books are dumb. And she was looking at that, and at first she thought, well, they're doing badly at it, so they got a bad attitude. But then she said, I started looking, and she's a feminist, she's a journalist. And she said, I started looking at it, and all the books were in pastel colors, and they were all about she-wrote. They were written by women, the teacher is a woman, most everybody at school was a woman, the only male figures they saw at school sometimes was the janitor. Everything was from a woman's point of view, and they found it kind of boring. And they've done experiments where they have separated boys and girls, and they put boys where you have to get up and move around and hands-on, and their grades go up. God made little boys to be able to work and do things. And if you sit a little boy down for all day long and just read to him and stuff, he's going to, and when they start, if you look, go to Center of Disease Control description of ADD, ADHD, and everything, there's not a blood test for that. There's a list of behaviors. And if it has been problematic for over 6 months and an expert says that's the case, it says don't diagnose yourself, and here's the things. Read the list of things. One of them is doesn't like to do things for a long period of time that involve thinking real hard. Boys! I was talking about this in Atlanta, and one of the school teachers said, yeah, I have to fill out these forms. And I have to write, yes, yes, yes. And she said, I want to write on there, he's a boy. Now, some of it is bad-behaved boys and boys that haven't been disciplined. And there may be a situation where you, between you and your doctor, you may know that in your family, yes, you really do need this medication. Okay, that's a decision between you and your doctor. If you've got a second or third opinion or whatever, and you know that, that's your family. It's not any of our business to tell you what your family needs because you're responsible for your children. They're your children. God gave them to you, and we're not to make the call there. And your child may need a medication. But don't automatically start drugging kids because this teacher or that doctor, I've had people tell me, yeah, within 5 minutes the doctor said he's got to have this. Watch out for some of those things. Number 19, lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. This happens a lot. It's not directly addressed in Scripture, but in Luke chapter 15, it's interesting. Jesus didn't have to mention the birth order, but he did. It's a little detail, and it fits reality. a man had two sons. One of them wanted all the money to go away and party. Was it the older brother, the firstborn, or was it the lastborn? It was the lastborn. There's a pattern there. And if you will think about families that you know, the family you grew up in, your uncles, your aunts, your cousins, families, you know, that you've operated with, how many times have you seen this pattern? The firstborn is responsible. The firstborn is an overachiever. The firstborn, you know, they get a good job. The firstborn, they get a good house. The firstborn, they're making wise decisions. The firstborn is doing these things. And here's the middle ones. You got your problem, middle ones. And then here's the lastborn over here. And I had a lady tell me one time, she had two children. One, she and her husband had a good family business. They had a beautiful home. They had nice kids. You know, life's going well. The other child lived in the garage, didn't have a job, smoked pot. I said, "Was he your youngest?" She said, "How'd you know?" It's not always that way, but it is often that way. Why? Consider these reasons with me. It is not necessarily that way, but it's not uncommon, and there's some logical reasons. Number one, what percentage of time, parenting time, did you give to your firstborn? All of it, right? After you've got, like in my case, six kids, how much of my parenting time did the baby get? A good bit of it, because the older ones don't need as much, but does it get all of it? Number two, pacifier. Moms, I want you to remember when you had your first baby. Baby number one, here's a human being, and it's yours, and you're responsible for it, and that pacifier fell and hit the floor of the convenience store or, you know, Walmart or the garage or a bathroom. Or what did you do with that pacifier? You might have thrown it away. Into the shower, you got a bunch. Just get out another one. Or at least you got hot water and you sterilized that thing, right? Were you that careful on baby number two? Cold water. Baby number three? Baby number four? Let the dog lick it. You know, but why? Here's why. We found out that they weren't as vulnerable as we thought they were. Because it's careful which we were about that pacifier, we turn around and we see one of them licking a boot. You know, ah, and he didn't die. You know, he's eating out of the dog food, ah, and he didn't die. And so, he made it to 6 years old. Oh, it's because I was careful about the pacifier. Oh, no, it wasn't. And so we realized, you know what, I'm not going to worry about it that much. Now, what did we do with behavior with that firstborn? Did he have to say thank you to grandma before he got that cookie? He had to say thank you. If he didn't say thank you, did he get the cookie? No, he did not. Did he have to say please? Yes. If he wouldn't say please, did he get that cookie? No, because you were going to have a well-behaved child, right? Good. And then he's 6 years old, and what does everybody say everywhere you go? Oh, he is so good. He is so good. And then without thinking about it, we do two things. We think, oh, this was easier than I thought. And we start thinking that the manners being, I was more careful than I needed to be. Mistake. See, he didn't survive because I sterilized the pacifier, but he did learn manners because you trained him. But we end up letting off on both of them. Next, when the firstborn comes into the world, and you might remember this in your own birth order. How many of you were firstborns? When you came into the world, everybody in your house was what? An adult. So who did you model your behavior after? Adults. Firstborns are eager to do mature things because they're looking at adults and they model after that. How many of us came into the house after somebody else had already done the other thing? And if you come in later in the birth line, you come in, there's a bunch of kids in the house. Now who are a lot of your role models? Kids. And that's okay, But do you see how that makes a difference in kind of the maturing rate sometimes? Just keep it in mind. And then there's this. Mom, when you had your firstborn, you had a baby book. And you were eager to record, and you couldn't wait till each step happened. You couldn't wait for that first smile. I mean, was that a smile? And then the day she did smile. Oh, it was a real smile. And you marked it in the baby book. And when she got her first tooth, you marked. And when he took his first step, you were excited. And you called your mom and everything. He took his first step. And you've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And you were so glad that happened. And then you had baby number two. Then you had baby number three. And now what do you start noticing? When you had that first baby, and it was 3 weeks old, and it's just drooling and everything, you loved him to death. But, you know, you were kind of looking forward to when they can do something. But now, a few years later, you're realizing what happened time-wise. Oh, it went by so fast. And then you have your last one. And you start thinking, what? I don't want this one to grow up too fast. So you leave him in diapers longer because it's cute. Oh, he's toddling along. It's so nice to have a toddler. And it's so cute. And so you just don't expect as much of them. Fast forward 25 years. Your first ones are respectable. They're taking care of things. And then they start asking you, why are you letting him live in the garage, smoke pot, and he doesn't have a job? And mom says, don't you say that about my baby. He's not a baby. He's 35 years old, smoking pot in the garage. It's not a baby. Yes, little kids are adorable, but that little kid, the last one, needs the same training and teaching as the other one. It's not his job to be your little baby forever. He needs to grow up and be a man. I'm going to try to do this in 5 minutes and be done. Pleaser versus strong-willed. Now, I apologize for going over time. I ended up talking about the humility a lot longer than I wanted to, but I'm not disappointed I did because it's that important. If you've had several children, you know that you've seen this, probably. You've had a child that is eager to please mom and dad, and they're pretty easy. And you've had one that was really self-willed and kind of independent, and you can get them to do the right thing, but, you know, the first one, if they disappoint mom and dad, oh, they're brokenhearted, and this one is like, okay, I'll do this. If you train them, they'll do it, but it's like they don't care quite as much what other people think of them, okay? Have you had both of those kind of kids? Some moms get really upset, or dads, because they say, why can't my child be like the older one? Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you be like your sister? And sometimes they say that to them. Why can't you be like so-and-so? Why can't you be like so-and-so? This is a different child. And don't start thinking, oh, this one doesn't need any training and this one's wrong. Both of them have something really valuable and both of them need to be trained. Your pleaser needs to be trained as well. And your independent one needs to be trained. But your independent one has some strengths that your pleaser doesn't automatically have that you're going to need to train into the pleaser and vice versa. Let me illustrate. So, my first one, she was a good little girl. Oh, she was a good little girl. And we had some people over, and they had a little boy, and he was a stinker. And I knew he was a stinker. So when I walk into the room and I see the little boy that's a stinker with an ink pen just drawn on the wall of my house, it was not a surprise because he was a stinker. Who's that standing next to him? Here's him drawn on the wall, and right beside him is my little girl writing on the wall. You see, you know what pleasers like to do? They like to please people. Jesus said, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Pleasers like to fit in and please other people, but if you don't put some backbone in that child, what are they going to do when they go to a party and people want to go shoplifting or do some drugs or something else? or make fun of the kid over there or something, what's the pleaser going to do? Going to fall right in line. That child needs some backbone. Now, if you've got a stubborn child, congratulations. He's got a backbone. But he needs to be trained also. Because starting off, his backbone is all for who? Himself. But he's got that backbone. Train him to put it in service to God. I do not know what Paul and Barnabas were like as children, but I'm going to ask you to venture a guess. Think about Paul. When he's persecuting Christians, he's going into houses and he's tying up men and women. Do you suppose there's some kids crying? His mom's being dragged away? Did it seem to faze Paul? When Paul becomes a Christian and the people that used to be on his side want to kill him, is that going to stop Paul? Nope. When Barnabas wants to take John Mark and Paul thinks, nope, I don't think we should. Does he think, oh, I don't want to hurt Barnabas' feelings or John? Paul's going to do what Paul thinks he ought to do, right? Barnabas. Oh, it's a good thing we have Barnabas's. His name was Joseph. The apostles named him son of encouragement, son of exhortation. When other people wouldn't trust Paul, who's willing to give Paul a chance? Barnabas. When the church up in Antioch of Syria needs somebody, who do the apostles send up? Barnabas. When John Mark bailed out on the first trip, who wants to give him another chance? Barnabas. And when Peter starts acting hypocritically in Galatians chapter 2, who's there right beside him? Barnabas. If you were going to guess, which of those boys might have said, their mother said, oh, he's got a lot, he's got a strong will. I'm going to guess it might have been Paul. And who do you suppose might have been naturally inclined to please people? I'm going to guess it might have been Barnabas. Now, you will see Barnabas stand up for what's right. And you will see Paul tenderheartedly think about other people. But both of these children need training. Don't look at them as, oh, God gave me one good one, and this is bad. I used to have a mom, she used to call me up. There's something wrong with this one. There's something wrong with this one. There was something wrong with the way she was relating to that one. Both of them need training. And you will see people in the church. There's somebody that's just so encouraging, so kind, so helpful. They're just so gentle-hearted and such. But then when sin needs to be stood up against, oh, they don't like confrontation. Oh, maybe we shouldn't. And then you'll have that brother, you know, well, we need to talk about this. I'll go talk to him. You know, I've been looking for a fight. He's probably a different angle. He might need, both of them need to learn something. Both can be of use, and we need Paul's and we need Barnabas's, but they both need to learn the other sides of things as well. So, win and your child wins. Take the time, teach them to do right, train them to do right, expect them to do right. Thank you for bearing with me while I went over time. If you're here this evening and you need to respond to the gospel invitation, when the younger brother ran away, he came back and repented. The older brother needed to do some repenting too. If you need to repent before your God, if you need to be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of your sins, if there's sin in your life, make it right with, then you're already a Christian, make it right with God. If there's sin in your life and it involves the congregation, make it right with them. Let's stand and sing the song selected.